The headlines this hour. Iran begins a major military exercise in the Persian Gulf region as it warns against any attack on its military and nuclear sites. Russia warns of a possible military response if NATO fails to ease its security concerns as the Western military alliance expands its presence in Eastern Europe. Also, the headlines, monsoon-triggered floods leave a trail of death and destruction in Malaysia, forcing thousands of people to flee their homes on the country's east coast. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps launches large-scale military drills in the south of the country, involving a variety of units. The maneuvers are codenamed the Great Prophet 17. They are held in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz regions, as well as the coasts of Hormuzgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The IRGC Deputy Commander for Operations says the ground, naval, and aerospace divisions, as well as some popular forces, participate in the exercises. Abbas Neil Furushan says the theme of the drills is might, security, and active deterrence under the auspices of national unity, solidarity, and unanimity. Says the objective of the drills is to increase the combat readiness of IRGC forces by using the most advanced equipment and tactics to counter enemy threats and combined arms warfare. Meanwhile, a senior Iranian military commander has warned of a crushing response to any attack on the Islamic Republic's military and nuclear facilities. During our news review program, we discussed the issue with our guest. Let's take a listen.
A top Iranian military commander is warning that the Islamic Republic will give a crushing response to any attack on its military and nuclear sites. The commander of the Khatam al-Anbiya Central Headquarters has warned that Iran will not hesitate in its response. Major General Ghulam Ali Rashid says Iran will target the source of aggression, the base, the territory, and the airspace used for any possible attack. He said that any Israeli threat against Iranian sites will be impossible without the U.S. support. Back in September, the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs said that the regime is preparing a strike on Iran. American and other Israeli officials have made similar suggestions over the past months. All right, now let me invite two guests and ask their opinion about this. So John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joining me from Basel, Switzerland. Also, we have Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who's joining us out of London. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. And let me turn to John and Basel. John, as you just heard in the intro, Iran is also at the same time conducting some military drills, and they are annual and they are regularly actually held. But on the other hand, we have the Israeli officials every now and then, almost maybe once or twice every month recently, they are making open threats against Iran. They are saying that they have allocated a certain budget and they're doing this and doing that, and the military option is on the table against Iran. And also we have the U.S. also declaring the same thing. So what's your assessment of this situation?
Well, unfortunately, the virus of uniqueness that the United States claims has spread to Israel, and they now behave as if they were also above the law, and that international law and the ban on aggressive actions against other countries don't even exist. This kind of what they call exceptionalism in the United States simply can't be accepted around the world. And this is the way that wars start. So the threats from Israel are clearly contrary to the spirit and the letter of international law. And Iran needs to take these matters up at all international bodies and to seek foreign partners to try to deter military action by the United States or Israel or together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Mohsen Abbas, how do you look at this? And the Iranian commander was also stressing that any possible attack by Israel will not be possible without a backing of the U.S.
Well, nothing Israel does is without the blessings of the U.S. Often it's confusing as to who's leading and who's actually following, but they seem to be a tag team, and the reality is that their interests seem to align in West Asia, imperialism and control and, if you like, plunder seem to be the main priority for Israel. Of course, it's also now a question of survival, they would argue. The bottom line is that they've oppressed Palestinians, they've robbed them of their lands, they've disrespected international law on every level. They continue to expand what they termed Palestinian territories by putting up all these settlements. And to boot, what Israel understands is that the only player in the West Asia which has any capability, inclination, or ability to challenge them is the Islamic Republic of Iran. Therefore, everything they do is geared towards, in one way or another, destroying the Islamic Republic, whilst maintaining their own, as my colleague said, exceptionalism in terms of no scrutiny of their nuclear weapons threat to the region, no scrutiny of their Yinon plan of expansion, zero scrutiny of their psyops in every nation around, which doesn't comply with their diktat, including Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and even Iran. Their black operations go on in all of these countries. The violation of the sovereignty of Syria is a daily practice through their military, aerial attacks. So actually, there's nothing reigning in Israel. They've been given pre-license by the Americans. They're armed by the Americans, essentially. Now the Israelis have developed their own defense industry. And of course, they're a rogue state. And the Americans themselves are a rogue state who don't accept international law on any level. Iran, of course, is standing strong, standing tall, and it's not willing to back down. The Israelis are now in America, the top administration is there, trying to push not only the destruction of the JCPOA agreement, the nuclear treaty that was signed with Iran by the major powers, but also they want them to get rid of their ballistic missiles. Which sane nation would, with the threat of Israel and its nuclear armed to the teeth military, want to give up ballistic missiles, and let alone, of course, this kind of notion of these phantom nuclear abilities that Iran has, which it clearly doesn't. The fact is, Israel wants war. It can't do it straight away because Iran is well equipped to counter their threat. So what they're resorting to is trying to get America involved to do its dirty work for them. And so far, the Americans aren't biting totally. Who knows how long that resistance will continue.
Okay, thanks for your comment. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst in Basel. Seth Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator in London.
Welcome back. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has held his weekly presser, with the ongoing negotiations between Iran and the 4+1 group of countries in Vienna being the focal point of the event.
The image we have from the JCPOA is a contradictory one. Some people say they are optimistic and there's been progress in talks, but at the same time, some Europeans say there is only a few weeks left, and they're giving an ultimatum to Iran, and they're worried about Iran's nuclear advances. They say the JCPOA has turned into an empty shell. Can you give us a clear image about the talks and the future of negotiations in Vienna, please? Thank you.
Well, basically, the two sides have to avoid warning comments. The words that are alarming do not have depth. I have already clearly announced, and now once again announced, that the Troika has to know that the JCPOA became void for Iran at a time when the U.S. withdrew from the deal and imposed unilateral sanctions against the Iranian nation, and the three European countries moved in line with the U.S. by not taking any action. I urge the other side to focus on negotiations in Vienna. Iran is neither optimistic nor pessimistic. Tehran is optimistic about the principle of negotiations, and the other side has to be optimistic about the principle of talks, too.
Khatibzadeh said that Tehran is very realistic about the path that it is taking, and that is why the Islamic Republic is taking measures to remove U.S. sanctions in the course of the negotiations. The spokesman noted that Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal have come up with two new draft documents, which are the results of intense negotiations in Vienna. He said the documents are the basis of future negotiations. Khatibzadeh said the draft documents could have been agreed upon much sooner if the other side followed the same approach that it did during the last days of the talks in Vienna. Tensions between Russia and the West over Ukraine drag on. Moscow has warned of a possible military response if NATO fails to come up with a political action to ease its security concerns. The warning comes from Konstantin Gavrilov, head of the Russian delegation to negotiations on military security and arms control in the Austrian capital, Vienna. Gavrilov has also accused the Western military alliance of hitting what he called Russia's sore spots. Last week, Moscow released a list of security proposals that it would like the U.S. and NATO to provide. This includes a promise the alliance would give up any military activity in Eastern Europe and in Ukraine. The West claims Russia may be preparing an invasion of its ex-Soviet neighbor. Moscow has denied the claim. It instead blames Kiev, its Western allies, for creating tensions near Russian borders. Chileans take to the streets in the capital, Santiago, to celebrate the victory of leftist candidate Gabriel Boric in the country's presidential runoff. Streets in other Chilean cities also erupted in celebration. Boric garnered 56% of the votes, with almost 99% of the ballots counted. His rival, far-right José Antonio Kast, secured 44%. Several Latin American presidents have sent congratulatory messages to Boric. He will take office for a four-year term, starting from March of next year. The new presidents will be dealing with some of Chile's big challenges, including high inflation, the COVID pandemic, and social unrest. He will also be in power for the approval of a new constitution that is in the process of drafting. At least 8 people are killed as monsoon-triggered floods ravaged the eastern coast of Malaysia. All fatalities have been reported from Selangor, the country's wealthiest and most populous region. Authorities say about 55,000 people have also been evacuated since Friday. Floods have caused many rivers to overflow, submerging both urban and rural regions and leaving vehicles stranded. 8 states have been affected, with Pahang being the hardest hit. Thousands of personnel from the army and other security agencies have been mobilized for rescue and rehabilitation efforts. But the government is facing criticism from the public and opposition lawmakers over its rescue efforts. Stormy monsoon seasons at the end of the year often bring deaths and devastation to Malaysia. The death toll from a devastating typhoon that swept across the Philippines has climbed to 375, making it one of the deadliest storms to strike the Southeast Asian country. According to police, at least 500 people have been injured, and dozens are still unaccounted for. There are fears that more people may have died due to widespread landslides and flooding. Meanwhile, the military has been ordered to send its airplanes and naval vessels to deliver aid to the affected areas. Super Typhoon Rai is the strongest to have hit the Philippines this year. It made landfall on Thursday, ravaging the country's southern and central regions. The storm has knocked out power and communication links in many areas. Over 380,000 people have been forced to flee their homes. More casualties in Sudan as crackdown on anti-coup protests continues. A Sudanese medical group has confirmed the death of one protester during a rally in the capital, Khartoum. An independent doctors' committee says the man died after being shot with a bullet in the chest. The health ministry says 123 protesters were also injured. There were also protests in several other cities. Sunday's rallies were among the largest since the military takeover led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan on October 25th. People continued to hit the streets despite the reinstatement of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, who was ousted in the coup. At least 46 people have been killed and scores wounded since then. The protesters want a full civilian rule. They are also against a recent deal between the military and Hamdok, as well as a military-dominated transitional government. New documents obtained by a leading U.S. daily reveal how the Pentagon has drastically undercounted civilian deaths from its airstrikes in 3 Muslim countries. Not only that, but also no one in the U.S. military has been punished for the deeply flawed air campaign in West Asia. This report takes a closer look at how an in-depth review of hundreds of secret files has blown the lid off a massive cover-up in the U.S. military.
An investigation into the confidential documents of the U.S. military has laid bare horrifying facts about the American air war in West Asia. The New York Times says it has reviewed more than 1,300 records drawn from a hidden Pentagon archive, and all that has shed more light on how U.S. airstrikes have resulted in thousands of civilian deaths in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, but have gone mostly underreported. Based on the U.S. military's own count, air raids have killed some 1,600 civilians in these countries over the past years. And even though the Times does not give a figure, it does say that the military has drastically undercounted the tally. A particular case that's been highlighted is a 2016 attack on a hamlet in northern Syria that the U.S. military said killed 85 Daesh terrorists. But as it turned out later, the victims were in fact 120 farmers and villagers. The high number of civilian deaths also hints at the deeply flawed intelligence plaguing the U.S. bombing campaign, as well as the hasty and imprecise targeting that is in sharp contrast to precision bombs and eagle-eyed drones propagated by the U.S. military. It also brings into question the Pentagon's claims of transparency and accountability. Based on the report, only a few assessments of faulty raids have been made public, and surprisingly, none have found any wrongdoing or led to disciplinary action. A more recent example is the U.S. drone strike that took the lives of 10 members of an Afghan family, seven of them children, in Kabul back in August. The Pentagon initially claimed that terrorists had been killed. Then it was forced to admit that the attack had been a tragic mistake, taking civilian lives. But eventually, it decided that no one would be punished for the erroneous strike. The New York Times says it has visited nearly 100 casualty sites in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, and interviewed scores of survivors to compile the report. Even though many civilian survivors now have to live with disabilities that require expensive treatment, only fewer than a dozen have received compensation. Despite such a terrible record, the U.S. keeps up with its air campaigns mostly in Muslim nations. Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army officer, believes it is time the international community moved to stop the U.S. war machine from spilling more innocent blood.
When is the world going to stand up and stop allowing the U.S. to call every other nation a state sponsor of terrorism and say that the United States is indeed the state sponsor of terrorism globally because it is engaged in the destruction of the world? When is the world going to stand up and tell the truth?
The U.S. Army carried out more than 50,000 airstrikes in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan between 2014 and 2019. The aim was allegedly to eliminate militants and terrorists and bring peace and stability to those countries. But those bombardments brought nothing other than death and destruction. And the U.S. has kept killing civilians with impunity and without accountability.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
This is a short part of some articles about Imam Khomeini's point of view on religion and politics. About politics and religion, Imam Khomeini says, prophets had two main objectives. They were sent in order to develop people's spirituality and those potentials, to free the poor from under domination of hegemony. Have had these two duties, the spiritual duty, which was to release people from the captivity of the carnal soul and to save them from tyranny. These were the prophet's duties. When one observes Moses and Abraham and what have been said about them in Quran, he realizes that they are also held the same two positions, the first being invitation of people to monotheism and the second being their liberation from tyranny and injustice.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to Spring of Truth. I am your host, Sayyid Abdullah al-Musawi, and we are looking at some point of views made by al-Imam al-Khumayni radwanullahi alayhi. In one of his speeches, Imam al-Khumayni said, if our intellectuals could understand the political objectives of these prayers, morning sessions, and passions play, they would not then question the holding of these gatherings or morning rituals. Many people around the world, be it Muslims or non-Muslims, most of the time they question us and they say, well, why are you guys gathering up? Why do you guys hold lectures and lessons and mornings and this and that? We're constantly being questioned. Sometimes we are being questioned by our own people. He who asks a question about these things, as in terms of why do you keep doing it, why is it being done every year, obviously they don't understand the importance of it or the political objectives of it, as Imam al-Khumayni says. So these mornings, they have a spiritual aspect, they have a religious aspect, they have educational aspect. At the same time, they have political aspects. They are places where people become aware of the political arena.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu alayhi.
Now you can see that in most of our gatherings and most of our speeches and lectures, you see that the clergy or the preachers themselves, they constantly keep mentioning political events. Now I, as a person, when I attend the Friday prayer, I become aware of many things that I wasn't aware of. Maybe because I got too busy, work, school, this and that, and I don't know what's happening in the political arena. But when I attend Friday lecture on a Friday prayer and the preacher starts to deliver his speech, they usually bring matters of politics to the people and make them aware of it and tell them what is right and what's wrong in this regard. So it is extremely important for me to be educated and on the right path when it comes to politics. So these gatherings, they are not only ritualistic, but they are in fact enlightening to us when it comes to politics and other issues. So we have to understand the reasons and why they are important. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Subhanallah. is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa, via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Economic divide.
Racial and ethnic inequality and racism. These are issues that are widespread in the U.S. But what if these issues came at an economic cost and not just small amounts? What if they ran in the trillions of dollars? Hi, I'm Kavit Ahwai. That appears to be the case in the U.S., which is what we will be looking at in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, these are some of the highlights. Racial inequality, racial output, $51 trillion lost in U.S. GDP. The exclusion of minorities, African Americans and Latinos in that mix is something that is highlighted in reports that have come out, one from a Federal Reserve CEO. Also, the roots of inequality, something that the U.S. Is plagued by, and some of the consequences, jobs, education, and pay, things that inequality shows itself in these different sectors. And one of the other highlights of our report and of our program today would be how COVID-19 has exposed inequality in the U.S., its impact on minorities, which has been more than whites, and how blacks and minorities are actually more jobless because of COVID-19.
Economic Divide looked at a study from a source within the U.S. Mary Daly, the San Francisco Federal Reserve president. She has said, the imperative for equity, for
for closing some of these gaps is not only a moral one, but is also an economic one. The study looked at three factors at the base. If black and Hispanic men and women held jobs at the same rates as whites, if they completed college at the same rates as whites, and if they earned the same as whites. From labor alone, they figured the gains would add up to $22.9 trillion over 30 years, from the years 1990 to 2019. The larger $51.2 trillion estimate factors in increase in capital investments that a more productive labor pool could be expected to trigger.
So we looked at, our thought experiment was, what if we equalized by gender, men and women, by race, different racial groups, and gave people the same opportunities in education, employment, occupational choice, and even how well they're allocated to jobs that demand the skills that they've already acquired. And what we found is all of those things matter. The big ticket items, of course, were getting people the right amount of education and then getting them in positions that are equivalent to their education and having them paid appropriately for the education and skills that they've earned. And those were things that, you know, they increase innovation, they increase productivity, and importantly, and this is the main bottom line, they increase economic output. We estimated that over the last 30 years, it's $30 trillion in lost economic output to our country.
So racial discrimination in the United States, that does not take us by surprise, even though it has reached alarming levels in that country. Yet looking at social media posts, it is still quite revealing what is not being done about it, which in turn is reflected economically in that country. I mean, take this entry, which is actually from the White House itself. It said the racial wealth gap has direct roots in discriminatory federal, state, and local policies. Well, let's take a look at what Joe Biden said, the current U.S. president, on his campaign trail. In this clip, which you're going to see, delivering remarks on his Build Back Better plan, which is on advanced racial equity in America's economy.
Most people wouldn't even think the Fed has anything to do with this. Its existing mandate promotes maximum employment and stable prices. Under my plan, I believe the Fed should add that to that responsibility and aggressively target persistent racial gaps in jobs, wages, and wealth, revise its hiring and employment practices, and achieve greater diversity at all levels of that institution, including diverse nominees for the Board of Governors and the regional banks.
Well, there you have Biden himself talking the reality, and it's glaringly obvious here how the U.S. is aware of the discrimination that's taking place. That it's not providing a fair representation out there when it comes to all segments of the society. And here is a person citing one of the unfortunate realities out there when it comes to people of color, especially African Americans. Now, the real aim of this program, how minorities, especially African Americans, are the hidden economy of the U.S., as represented through these successful African Americans.
I'm going to do this in reverse order. So first, I'm going to introduce Tristan Wilkerson. He's a general partner of High Street Equity Partners, focusing on investor relations, capital raising, and performance. Tristan is an experienced policy professional, angel investor, an entrepreneur with demonstrated success in both the public and private sectors. He's a former congressional aide. Our next speaker is Ron Busby. Ron is the president and CEO of the U.S. Black Chambers. Ron is a former successful business owner himself. He has been recognized as one of the nation's best CEOs.
Now, it wouldn't be fair if there was not an African-American female representation.
And last but not least, Olivia Bundles is the author of On Her Own Ground, The Life and Times of Madam C.J. Walker, which is the New York Times notable book about her entrepreneurial great-great-grandmother that was the inspiration for Self-Made, a fictional four-part Netflix series starring Octavia Spencer.
Okay, joining us in the studio is Graylin Hagler. He is a pastor and justice advocate. We also have the pleasure of having Marzia Hashmi with us. No need to introduce you, Marzia. Thank you, first of all, for coming.
Thank you
Journalist,
for inviting me.
Activist, and media personality. Okay, first let's listen to Graylin Hagler. Graylin, we have this report that is the basis of our program indicating that $51 trillion has been prevented from being contributed to the U.S. GDP and the segments of society in the U.S., minorities, which includes African Americans and also Latinos. Let me get your reaction on that, on why this has happened and if authorities are going to do anything about it, because they are aware of that this has actually happened.
Well, why they're not reacting to it is because there has been a historical and persistent racism that has existed in the United States of America, a discrimination from before emancipation. I mean, folks were held as chattel slaves at one point in this country. And then with the emancipation of the Emancipation Proclamation after the Civil War, folks were so-called set free. But there had been always numbers of things that continued to sabotage the economic advance of the black community, such as the Congress and their mismanagement of the Freeman's Savings Bank, which left 61,000 depositors with losses of nearly $3 million in 1874.
Yeah, well, the list goes on, as he was about to say there. Marzia, this is what's incredible here. We know about the discrimination. And that's what I want to hear from you about in summary form. And then you have the other side where minorities and African Americans are included in that, in a sense. They have been prevented from contributing to the U.S. GDP in terms of the economy, as you just cited some examples. So tell us what you think about that and if you have even personal experiences that you may contribute here.
Right. It is quite a paradox, Kaveh. On the one hand, you have the United States with the greatest economy in the world. And on the other hand, you have this minority group, especially African Americans, I'll look at that side of things, that have been prevented from even contributing to that economy in the way that they could have. And so in the long run, the United States has actually shot itself in the foot from actually preventing some of its citizens from reaching their potential. Yes, of course, I agree with Reverend Hagler and what he says, and of course I have personal experience. I don't think that there's a black American, especially my age, for sure, who has not experienced that. I grew up in a time that black parents taught their kids, you have to understand where you are, you have to work twice as hard to get half as far.
Yeah, and what's spectacular in this whole thing is the fact that you have U.S. authorities who are aware of that, and you have the current U.S. president on his campaign trail, in which he talked about how they're going to set aside a fund for people who have been prevented from actually getting their fair share or shake to contribute to U.S. society. We're going to listen to him, and then I'll come back with a reaction from you.
Sure.
That's what racial equity in our economy looks like. Here's another step we're going to take under my Build Back Better plan to fully include more people into the deal. We're going to strengthen the Federal Reserve's focus on racial economic equity.
All right. On his campaign trail, so I don't know if it's him making that then to get votes, or if he actually means what he's saying. Do you believe the president and whether he's going to follow through? I mean, how can you change something that's been in the U.S. society for so long in terms of discrimination?
We're talking about systemic racism.
Right.
We're talking about a system that has to be changed, not an individual that can make certain promises. We look at over the years, we have seen many candidates and many presidents even make many promises. I mean, even under the presidency of Obama, as a matter of fact, the situation for black Americans became worse. So, no, I don't think that there's anything that is going to be done just from a promise.
Very well. I wish we had more time to talk about this, but we do appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, Marzia Hashmi, here with us, journalist, activist, and media personality.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for coming. And we had Pastor and Justice Advocate Graylin Hagler speak to us before that. Now, the following is another experience of a person either of color or a minority and his or her experience with how they have been held back from contributing to the U.S. at least economic cycle.
The opportunity for good jobs, it wasn't there, you know, and sadly to say, you know, where I lived in New Orleans, is what I've experienced. I think it was more who you know at that time to get that job, and you didn't have to have a degree. And it's just so sad to say it, because a lot of people, they struggle because of that. You know, there were times where, even with school, you know, I couldn't even get my sons in a decent school.
Our infant news section is upon us, and as the end of the year is approaching us, can you believe it? We are not coming short on topics. Well, our first topic is about wealth inequality. A new report has revealed that the richest 1% took 38% of new global wealth since the year 1995, and the bottom half got just 2%. It went on to say that global inequities in wealth and income are, quote, about as great today as they were at the peak of Western imperialism in the early 20th century. There you go. That's how it stands. Next story, inflation. How many more times are we going to talk about this? But it is something that's persisting. Money-hungry corporations, this entry said, are to blame for it. Corporate profiteering is forcing workers and families to make unnecessary sacrifices so that wealthy executives can make themselves richer. And, of course, that means their pay. Well, the pay for median employees, well, that fell by 8%. So, obviously, you're looking at the inequality that happens there as a result of that. It's called a wage gap. Next up, we go to Sri Lanka. The economy there is not doing well. We reported on this a few months ago, and the problem is still there. As food and energy prices are soaring, Sri Lankans are going without their basic necessities. Now, one reason that is cited is that the Sri Lankan government, its efforts to hold on to foreign exchange reserves, is blamed for creating shortages of basic goods as a result. And our final look at news from this, or recent news, I should say, global arms sale. A recent report came out, and this is really not surprising, that weapons trade is booming. Profits are hitting record profits overall. $531 billion is what it came at for the year 2020. And the top five companies, they're all from the U.S. And one part of the world that it sold the most weapons to, West Asia, otherwise known to the rest of the world as the Middle East. And, of course, again, that comes in at a record. Well, the end of the year is upon us. And with that, we would really like to hear from you when it comes to, for example, topics that we should cover, like in this section, before the year is actually over. Now, the contact information is behind me. Make sure you drop us a line so that we can cover a story, especially in your part of the world.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is our in-depth section, which we will drive home how the disparities between whites and other races, which amounts to racial discrimination, cost the U.S. economy trillions of dollars. Let's take a look at the disparities between black and white men. We looked at businessmen. Here you have a white businessman, $100, and for the black businessman, they're $5.04. Now, what does this mean? It means for every $100 of white wealth, black families have only $5.04, if you can believe that. Now, the disparity also holds for wealthier black families. The 99th percentile black family is worth a mere, what do we have, $1,574,000, while the 99th percentile white family is worth over $12 million. That's a little less than $11 million, according to the Survey of Consumer Finances. Now, unemployment's great gauge of how the disparity shows itself there. People of color, which includes black, Latinos, Asian whites, and then all. When it comes to whites, they have a lower unemployment compared to the rest of them. The green line here, these are the whites. The timeline was February 2020 all the way through to December 2020. Let's try to get some sense out of it. Joining us for a breakdown of this is Darwin Fisherman, Darwin Fishman. He's a lecturer in sociology at San Diego State University in California. So Darwin, welcome. When we take a look at this report, there were ranges of $19 trillion all the way through to $51 trillion in terms of how much money to U.S.'s GDP blacks and minorities in general could have added. Well, why is it that these demographics have been held back from their contribution to U.S. society, economically speaking, of course?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Thank you. And yes, racism is real here, and definitely that's one way it manifests itself. You can see that in terms of things like income and salary and employment. And it's true that when you hear the numbers you just rattled off, it sounds horrible, and most people want to make a moral judgment. What we have a more difficult time wrapping our heads around is there's actually a lot of people that actually are not embarrassed by that and don't want to change that. The status quo is also really real, and it is based on that racism.
Well, when we take a look at an example of this, if I can pick one, Darwin, let's take a look at Wall Street, for example. They are accused of discrimination, looking at what they have done, for example, in terms of banking, as I'm seeing over here, options in minority neighborhoods for mortgages, things of that nature. There has been discrimination against African Americans especially, but overall minorities. Why is that happening?
Right. And again, media wants to separate the two, because once you establish, as that data suggests, the numbers you shared, there is the racism, it's not by accident. And so in that sense, trying to change it is not simply identifying the problem. Wall Street, in that sense, becomes even more extreme, because you can also make a really compelling argument on the other side that their success is based on the racism. That's baked into it. And we know that historically, if we go back to the history for Africans in this country, slavery was profitable. It's what set the U.S. aside from Europe and made the success that we had.
All right, let me thank our guest Darwin Fishman, lecturer in sociology at San Diego State University from California, spoke to us. Now, throughout the program, we're going to actually look at some case examples of either blacks, Latinos, or minorities, and the experiences that they have had when it comes to either racial discrimination or them being held back from contributing to the U.S. society.
We know very well that the pathway to generational wealth is owning a home, is having savings, is having life insurance, is having college savings accounts for our children. So we worked very hard to stay very simple and save to get to where we are. Over the years, the promotions, I think, helped as well, both for myself and for my husband, because even now, we aren't paid the same as our white counterparts.
When one takes a look at racism, there are instances of it that are either repeated or built upon from the past. And of course, this comes at an economic cost. These are some of the instances that prevent economic contribution from minorities, be it African Americans or Latinos. Take public education. This has actually been underfunded in many African American majority schools. As a result, skill acquisition and upward mobility is prevented. Employment discrimination happens in different forms, which makes it hard to escape things like poverty. And then there is the criminal justice system, higher incarceration rates for minorities, there are also higher guilty verdicts, even higher bail money, and greater chances of monetary sanctions. Employment discrimination among minorities is worth taking a look at, since there are many jobs that are characteristics of this group. Taking a look at this chart, it shows occupations with a high black worker concentration. The lowest is childcare workers, coming in at 17%. Home health aides, nursing assistants, security guards, and bus drivers are the higher ranking ones. But take a note at the average median wage, which falls below the standard wage, compared to whites. The median wage for all U.S. workers is around $42,000 per year, but 43% of black workers earn less than $30,000 annually. And take a look at the black share of the labor force, 12.9%. And here's something not reported or known in the U.S. Many black neighborhoods don't have sufficient access to goods and services that are taken for granted in other everyday white majority neighborhoods. One out of every five black households is situated in a food desert, defined by the USDA as a low-income neighborhood with inadequate access to food. In terms of housing, blacks have 53.7% of their income go toward housing, when the average should be 30%. When it comes to healthcare, black Americans are nearly 2.4 times more likely than white Americans to live in a neighborhood with limited healthcare services. And in terms of banking, bank branches have been closing rapidly in recent years. And according to FDIC, nearly half of all black households did not have enough banks in 2017, compared to just 20% of white households. Our final look is on the internet availability to minorities, especially blacks. This is a big one, since its effect is felt on a wide scale of U.S. economic activity. When it comes to broadband, black households are 50% more likely to live in areas with limited broadband service. And many internet service providers impose credit checks or require cash deposits from new customers. This is why black consumers are more likely to participate in e-commerce, since they are a segment that has become mobile first compared to the whites. If you feel we have left anything out, please let us know. We would love to hear from you. From me, Mahdi, it's goodbye until next week.
The problem of racial inequality in the U.S., particularly against African Americans and Latinos, is deep-rooted. As our guests have pointed out, some of this goes back to the days of slavery, in the case of African Americans. But so what? Does that mean that the status quo in the U.S. should continue? U.S. officials in charge, like the current President Joe Biden, and even the Federal Reserve, know that minorities have been held back in the U.S., as shown in the study that we revealed to you, and that they can greatly contribute to U.S.'s economic GDP. But how can that happen when you are looking at a greatly divided U.S., perhaps more than at any other time in U.S. history? That's something to think about. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you on board. Hope you enjoyed it. From Mikova Tahwai and the entire team at Economic Dividers, goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.